Good morning, folks. Today I have Dr. Stephanie Seneff of MIT talking to us about her work with glyphosate and how it damages you, me, and pretty much every other living thing on this planet. I had spoken with her a few days ago, but the recording turned out to be a little bit choppy, so she was kind enough to give me another slot today. So this is the second attempt, and the recording has been much better, thankfully. I asked her again to start off with her academic and professional background.
Yes, well, I have an undergraduate degree in biology from MIT, and I spent 1 year in graduate school in biology before switching into computer science for my PhD, and my thesis was on an auditory model for human processing of speech, so that certainly had a biology component. After graduating, I spent many years working in the field of computer science and natural language processing, developing spoken dialogue systems that would allow people to gain access to information sources on the web through a spoken dialogue with the computer. And it was about 7 years ago that I became interested in biology again. I've always been interested in biology, and I've always read, kept up with the biology interest. But about 7 years ago, I became much more interested, and in particular, I got concerned about the autism epidemic that I was seeing unfolding in the United States, and wanted to try to understand what might be causative in this epidemic. And I was assuming that it must be some kind of environmental toxin or some combination of environmental toxicants that were causing it. And so I took upon myself, first of all, to inform myself as much as I could of the autism literature to figure out what is autism at the biological level. It turns out to be a very complex disorder with many facets. And at the same time, looking at all these chemicals to see which one or which combination might be, could explain the features of autism. So I undertook this activity, and I used my computer science skills to help me analyze the literature in the process, and also to analyze data, for example, from things like the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System that the U.S. government maintains. So I got more and more interested in the biology over time, and actually today I spend most of my time in biology rather than computer science. I still have I'm still working in this area of using the computer science techniques to help process the research literature and the databases that are on the web.
So, Stephanie, would you say that your combined experience, knowledge, and expertise in biology as well as computer science system has been useful in this particular line of research?
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, it was very interesting for me to analyze the VARS database. And I've published several papers deriving from the insights that I gained from looking at statistical analyses of the words frequencies in the VARS adverse event reports. And this allowed me to uncover very interesting relationships, for example, among preeclampsia, which is a condition in pregnancy, and pernicious anemia, which is a consequence of cobalamin B12 deficiency, and autism. All three of those link up in interesting ways that you can discover by analyzing side effect or reactions to vaccines under different conditions, and sorting the vaccine data into piles and then looking at statistical differences. It's a great method. I've used the same method very successfully for drug side effect data, and was able to come up with a big list of side effects of statin drugs. Statin drugs disrupt the mevalonate pathway, which is a crucial pathway in all the cells. And so the statin drug side effects give you a window into the things that the mevalonate pathway does. So it's actually a very good probe for understanding biology. Then I would go to the research literature and collect a whole bunch of papers on these topics that were suggested by my analysis of the databases. So it's a back and forth between the databases and the research literature, with using computer techniques on both sets of data to uncover correlations among things and then to deduce explanations for those based on the biology. It's a wonderful technique.
Oh, wonderful. Very nice. So did the work of Professor Dr. Don Huber influence you in some way, any way?
Absolutely. And in fact, I had been looking at the logical things for autism, possible toxic chemicals in the environment, including things like aluminum and mercury from the vaccines, obviously, which a lot of people are suggesting, and also other things like lead and and various plastics and all the things, and none of them were working. So I was very frustrated. After about 5 years of research, I had a very good understanding of the pathology of autism, and I had written papers describing how disrupted gut bacteria seemed to be the first step. And following that, then I could explain everything and how the bacteria disruption would lead to brain pathology, and that would lead to the symptoms of autism. So I wrote papers on this with frustration, because I always said in the papers I didn't really know why the bacteria were being disrupted, but that was the beginning. So it was very pleasing for me when I went to hear Don Huber. He gave a two-hour lecture that I attended. And this was September of 2012, so not that long ago. And in that moment, it was a crystalline moment for me when I suddenly realized that I understood what was causing autism from that lecture. And he made it very clear that that glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in the pervasive weed killer Roundup, would cause a disruption of gut bacteria. And then from that, I had the rest of the story. I was very excited. I came back from that two-hour lecture, and immediately, well, fortunately, I hooked up with Anthony Samso. He is an expert on environmental toxins, and he had been aware of the problems with glyphosate for many years, and he was extremely well-informed. He has extensive knowledge of chemistry, a very intuitive knowledge of chemistry, I might add, because he's had personal experience in working with various chemical substances. And he just poured into my brain a huge number of articles on glyphosate, and I just basically spent months doing nothing but learning about glyphosate. And it has an amazing number of different facets to it, a really fascinating chemical with a combination of consequences that are really disturbing to the body. So it disrupts the body in many ways, starting with the gut bacteria. So yes, that's sort of what happened historically, was those first few months after I came back from that talk that Don Huber gave in September of 2012.
I have some more questions in this aspect, this so-called autism spectrum. Do we have tools these days where we can identify a larger number of people falling into it compared to before? Did we have any data on this, say 100 years ago, how many people were falling under this category?
You could just go back to 1970. 1970, the rate was 1 in 10,000. Today, so a year ago, there was a phone poll by the CDC. They came up with 1 in 50. And just recently, they came out with a number of 1 in 68, which is a measure of kids who are today 12 years old. If you look at children who are from 0 to 10, you're going to find the numbers higher.
So in other words, 12 years old, that means 12 years ago it might have been 1 in 68?
Basically, people born 12 years ago are facing today 1 in 68. People born today are probably facing, I don't know, maybe 1 in 20?
Oh, I see.
I mean, it's really scary. If you do the math, I tried to do the math, 1 in 42, I think the telephone poll would probably be 1 in 42 if you did it today. Given the 1 in 68, which is a 30% rise since 2 years ago. And then if you think of boys, it would probably be 1 in 30. So this is a telephone poll for kids over various ages, you know, where you just ask the parents, do you have autistic kids in your family, how many, and then you collect those statistics. That's basically what that amounts to.
I see. So
possibly 1 in 30 boys today, but kids born today would be higher than that. So maybe 1 in 20. I mean, it's a terrifying number.
And where is it leading? I mean, at the end of the decade or 10 years from now, 15 years from now, where is it likely to be if it is rising so rapidly?
I mean, I can guess, I could project 1 in 2 by the quarter century mark. So half the kids will be on the autism spectrum that are born in 2025 if we stay the course. This is what I see. And we are staying the course because we are, the use of Roundup on corn and soy has gone up alarmingly in the last 15 years, since the introduction of the GMO Roundup Ready corn and soy. It's been a phenomenal success. They can pour the Roundup on the crop doesn't die. They're not even really measuring how much is in the crop, how much is in the food that's derived from the crop. They assume that it's non-toxic, so they don't care how much is in it. And as a consequence, we have been poisoning our children with glyphosate more and more every year. And right in step with the increase in autism, if you look at the math, if you look at the graphs of the autism rate as measured by the U.S. school system for those kids who qualify for assistance on the autism spectrum disorder category, you could plot that number over time, and you could correspond that with the number that you can also get on the web. Both of these numbers are maintained by the U.S. government, of the amount of Roundup used on corn and soy, and it's a perfect match. The correlation coefficient is 0.99. You don't get that kind of correlation. That is very, very unusual.
Mm-hmm. I see. So another question, there is this province of Punjab where they started using chemicals in their agriculture early on, and at one time it became a breadbasket. Now it has become a disaster story where people are leaving, the younger generation are leaving, and there is cancer all over the place, even among children. I don't know whether they can measure autism or not. My question is, if glyphosate is responsible for a whole lot of diseases, autism being one of them, which is preoccupying you and it is alarming, I agree. But can it also have a side effect such as cancer, which is easier for people to identify in rural or faraway places?
Absolutely. I mean, I think glyphosate is causing an increase in a number of different cancers. I can name which ones. And in fact, Nancy Swanson is a physicist who has gathered a bunch of data on various diseases and looking for which diseases have correlations with Roundup on corn and soy. So she's finding an interesting set. And then I go back to the literature to try to understand, to explain the biology, how could glyphosate be causing these diseases to go up? And in particular with the cancer, she has seen thyroid cancer, pancreatic cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has been identified in association with glyphosate in the literature. So there's at least those three. I suspect also breast cancer and prostate cancer are affected as well.
Okay, we go to the next one. Can one do this test in a lab? I'm asking because I'm not a biology person. Is it possible to check in a lab, and has anybody done it, to see how individual bacteria react or get sick or whatever? What happens to it when it's in contact with glyphosate, or that's not possible?
That is possible. In fact, people have done that. In fact, there are papers, for example, on E. coli that show, E. coli are a very common bacterium in the gut, and it shows that they switch over to anaerobic metabolism in the presence of glyphosate. So it's messing up their ability to use oxygen to process things like sugar. So, for example, glucose processing would be problematic for them under those circumstances, which might suggest then a link to diabetes, which, of course, is also going up in step with glyphosate usage on corn and soy.
I see.
In humans. And so, but you could do it as individual experiments with bacteria, but you can also look at animal models where you can feed the animal glyphosate contain, you know, put small amounts of glyphosate in their food sources or their water, and then measure their fecal material to see what's happening to the bacteria. And you can do this also, of course. So basically, people can do these kinds of experiments. You can also look at, for example, there was an experiment that was done on cows. So this is not explicitly looking at the glyphosate, but they fed, pigs. And this is a paper that just came out by Judy Carman et al. And it they showed pigs that were fed Roundup-ready corn and soy diet produced inflamed gut. And inflamed gut is a consequence of an overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria. That causes an inflammation in the gut as the body's immune system tries to kill off these bacteria that are overgrowing. You can also see that glyphosate would kill the bacteria because it chelates important minerals that they need to survive, and it preferentially kills the beneficial bacteria such as lactobacillus. And that allows then a hole where these pathogenic forms can now overgrow because the good bacteria are being killed off. It becomes an imbalance in the bacteria that leads to the inflamed gut, which goes into leaky gut, and this is, of course, a very common feature in autism.
Mm. So you came to this issue of cation. So can I say this you know, this glyphosate is often described as a chelator, and I had to educate myself on what it means. I understand it grabs onto certain metals, if I may call it. So these cations, as metal ions and all that, minerals and enzymes that we need, How important are these for our health, and why are our microbiota, our microbiome, our gut bacteria important with regard to these items for our health?
That's a big question, and it's a big answer. Let me see if I can say it simply. It's really interesting how much the body depends upon these minerals. We only depend upon small amounts, but it's absolutely essential to the function of many of our enzymes, and including our bacteria depend on them as well. People are familiar with things like iron, magnesium, but there's also cobalt and molybdenum and zinc and copper and manganese. And these minerals are really important to the body, and the body has developed a really sophisticated mechanism to deal with them because they can be toxic as well. Anything that's reactive is both good and bad, but the body is clever about being able to manage these minerals in interesting ways, and in part that depends critically on the bacteria who get a first chance to grab them. For example, cobalamin is the only enzyme that depends on cobalt, and we have bacteria in the gut that produce the cobalamin, which wraps this complicated molecule around the cobalt atom to keep it both safe and useful to the body. So when those bacteria, so the glycosate chelates the cobalt, which prevents those bacteria from having access to it. Therefore, the cobalamin is not made, and we become deficient. And that leads directly to this pernicious anemia that I talked about earlier, which is seen as a condition that induces an increased reaction to vaccines. So in having a pernicious anemia due to cobalamin deficiency causes you to be susceptible to bad reactions from the aluminum and mercury that's contained in vaccines. Interestingly, the actual number of reports in the VARS database has been going up over the years in step with the increased use of glyphosate on corn and soy. That's also very highly correlated.
What database?
Glyphosate is making the kids more susceptible to the vaccines.
Oh, I see. So the kids falling sick because of vaccination is going up along with the rise in glyphosate for all these complicated interrelations. That's what you're saying, right?
But I'm saying more than that, because the number of reactions that are being reported is going up more than the number of vaccines that are being given. It's enhanced by the presence of the glyphosate that's making the vaccines more toxic than they would otherwise be.
I see. So you answered that one. Here is a question about the kids, about the 12-year-old record that you mentioned. There is one part is a kid is born with autism. Another is a kid can become autistic although she was born healthy. Is that possible? Both are possible?
Both are possible. And in fact, regressive autism is going up more rapidly than autism at birth. And I think it's a consequence of the accumulation of toxic exposure in the child's lifetime. Particularly, of course, there are now more vaccines. There's more aluminum in the vaccines. And, of course, there's more glyphosate in the environment. That combination is really deadly because the glyphosate actually chelates the aluminum and escorts it to the brain and drops it off there. So both the glyphosate, at least this is what I'm analyzing to be the case, and I infer this in part from a paper that was recently written coming out of Sri Lanka where they had a similar phenomenon happening with arsenic. Arsenic and aluminum are very similar because both of them are plus three cation, which is quite unusual. The body doesn't use either one of them. Both of them are toxic, so we don't need them for anything whatsoever, and we're usually very good at keeping them out. But glyphosate acts like a stealth bomb. It chelates these atoms of arsenic and aluminum and therefore is able to bring them past the barriers, past the gut barrier, past the brain barrier, into the brain, where they, and of course, in the case of the arsenic and the Sri Lanka story, the glyphosate brings it into the bloodstream and delivers it to the kidney and then unloads it there. So because the kidney has a more acidic environment, the glyphosate unloads the arsenic, and then both the glyphosate and the arsenic then become toxic to the kidney. And so what's happening in Sri Lanka, there's an epidemic of kidney failure among young agricultural workers in fields of sugarcane, who work in the sugarcane fields. And it's become, just as it has with both wheat and barley and other products as well, but sugarcane is now being sprayed routinely with glyphosate right before the harvest in order as a desiccating agent. and as a ripening agent. And so this paper analyzed the situation very carefully, looking at the various differences among places where they didn't have the kidney failure and where they did. And what they identified was that the glyphosate was a key part of the problem, combined with too much arsenic in the soil. So the glyphosate caused the arsenic to kill the kidneys. So this is analogous to what I think is happening with the aluminum in the vaccines. The glyphosate is making the aluminum much more toxic than it would otherwise be.
I see. So I'm almost tempted to ask, if aluminum is so bad, why the heck do they use it in the vaccine? But that will be going into another...
It is a good question to ask, and I wonder it myself. They've managed to get approval for aluminum as an adjuvant. It actually makes the vaccine much more effective in terms of actually taking and giving the first child the immunity that they're looking for. So they can use a lot less antigen, which is the actual virus that they're immunizing them against, by adding in the aluminum. And so why they think this is a safe thing to do, I do not know. And there's been several papers have been written showing how toxic aluminum is to the brain. It's very clear that it causes dementia in people who are on dialysis. People who have kidney failure and are put on dialysis treatment have to be very, very careful not to get aluminum contamination in the dialysis, or they'll end up with dementia.
Mm-hmm. So, next question, is the gut bacteria of humans, the distribution of gut bacteria, are they more or less identical between all people, or are they unique for each?
Each person has a unique set of gut bacteria. There's a huge number of different species and a very complex mix. So, definitely not... It's a very complicated story, and it's not easy to decode, which is part of why it's hard to figure out what's happening.
Oh, I see.
But lactobacillus are very, very important, and they're the ones. They are actually very sensitive to manganese deficiency, and manganese is chelated by glyphosate. That's what causes the disruption of the shikimate pathway, which is supposed to be the toxic element in glyphosate exposure to plants. The bacteria all have the shikimate pathway. The argument of why glyphosate is supposedly not toxic to humans is that we don't have this pathway, the shikimate pathway, that glyphosate disrupts. But the gut bacteria all have this pathway, and the lactobacillus critically depend upon manganese to be healthy. So the glyphosate chelation of manganese prevents the lactobacillus from maintaining their number, and so they get clobbered. Lactobacillus is definitely linked to anxiety. So when there is lactobacillus supplements, you can get probiotics of lactobacillus that will help treat anxiety that's found in association with things like chronic fatigue syndrome. And they communicate, lactobacillus communicate with the brain and sort of cause it to lose the anxiety. It's really, really interesting. The microbes have a very strong communication network with the brain. And so there's a monitoring of their health. When they're not healthy, we're not healthy, and our brain becomes disabled.
Hmm. Okay, so we mentioned this shikimate pathway, and that bacteria use it, plants use it, but higher animals like ourselves do not. Would it be right to say that we do not own, not because we don't need the product, but actually we use it through our gut bacteria? Is that a right way of saying it?
That's exactly right. We depend upon them to produce the output of the shikimate pathway because we need them to produce that for us. Because we don't have that pathway, we can't produce those products. And those products are the essential aromatic amino acids, tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine. And they are incredibly important to us because they are precursors to several very, very important biomolecules, such as serotonin, melatonin, melanin, dopamine, thyroid hormone, folate, epinephrine. These things are all derived from the shikimate pathway. So when we don't have enough precursors to those molecules, we can't produce enough of those molecules. And so you see things like serotonin deficiency, which is associated with autism, but also with Alzheimer's disease, depression, violent behavior, and obesity. So all of those things are growing, you know, right now in frequency in the population, I suspect due to the inability to produce enough serotonin because we don't have enough precursor coming from our gut bacteria.
So in other words, is it fair to say that the argument that glyphosate is safe for humans because it works on the shikimate pathway, which humans do not use, this argument is false. Is that correct?
It's absolutely false. I mean, because, you know, it's obvious that we need the product of the pathway that's produced by the gut bacteria. So it's not like we can live without that product. It's just that we don't use our own cells to make it. We just rely on the gut bacteria to do it for us.
Yeah, okay, so that part...
And they're the ones who get exposed to the glyphosate the most because it's coming right into the gut.
Hmm. So if glyphosate in the food and in the groundwater and in the environment is damaging to humans, can it also be damaging to wild animals, birds, insects, and the living world?
Absolutely. And in fact, I've been looking into all these various die-offs that we've been seeing recently. We were suffering from a major crisis in many different species. The monarch butterfly comes to mind. Of course, the bees, the bee colony collapse syndrome. Starfish are dissolving on the west coast of America. And we have the ladybug. The ladybug has practically disappeared. When I was a child, you know, I remember going outside and finding all kinds of insects, you know, that I don't see anymore. Even things like grasshoppers and praying mantises and beetles. I mean, they used to be all over the place outside in the outside environment in the suburbs, very similar to where I'm living today. And now I don't see any. I mean, the insects are all being killed. And then, of course, the bats are getting killed, too. These are animals that eat insects that are being... Bats eat insects. They eat their weight in insects every day. And they've got this white nose syndrome now that I believe is a consequence of glyphosate poisoning from the insects that they're eating, that are eating the crops that contain the glyphosate. That's a second generation. The same thing with the ladybugs. They eat aphids, and aphids grow on corn. And so you have the GMO Roundup Ready corn feeding glyphosate to the ladybugs, which is why they've disappeared. It's just really tragic what's happening to the animals. The starfish is another story. I believe they're getting poisoned by glyphosate, which is being sprayed on oysters to kill the seagrass that's growing around the oysters. And the starfish come to eat the oysters, and they get exposed to the glyphosate, and this then causes their skeleton to dissolve. And I can explain why that is, because manganese is a critical catalyst for the enzymes that produce the skeleton. Structure of the skeleton depends upon manganese.
It looks like a disaster in the making on a global scale.
Absolutely. I think it is terrifying at all dimensions. I think it's going to potentially destroy life on Earth as we know it.
Hmm. So how does the Roundup Ready crop manage to survive while everybody else is suffering?
Yes, it's a clever trick. So what they've done is they've introduced a bacterial gene. They found a bacterium that did not die in the presence of glyphosate, and then they were able to figure out which gene in that bacteria was giving it that protection, and so they introduced that gene into the crop. And I think what it is, and I'm not sure of this, is it causes the crop to produce an overabundance of the enzyme that glyphosate disrupts. So by having so much of the enzyme, the crop is able to produce, to make the shikimate pathway work, despite the exposure to the glyphosate.
I
know that's one way in which a plant can overcome it. I'm not sure that's the way that particular enzyme or molecule works in the protein, works in the bacterium, but it's something of that sort.
Okay, here is another question with regard to this Roundup Ready or GMO crop. We get asked often this question whether GMO crop is, let's say, better food value or it has more nutrient and all that. And here is my question. If certain amount of energy is now to be spent by this crop in doing whatever this inserted gene is doing, like producing excess amount of enzymes or fighting off glyphosate or whatever, if it has to do extra work on that line, is that energy not taken away from what it would have otherwise done, that is, add nutrition to the fruit?
Right. I mean, I can't imagine that it's able to compensate for glyphosate without some kind of sacrifice on the part of the plant. And they talk about substantially equivalent, and I don't believe it. I mean, I don't think that the GMO crops are substantially equivalent to the others. Certainly, they're not equivalent in terms of the amount of glyphosate that's present. And there was a paper that came out that compared organic conventional and GMO versions of soy, and they looked at, they found several differences in the distributions of different fats, fatty acids and whatnot, but they also found that only the GMO Roundup Ready soy had significant residue of glyphosate and AMPA in it. The other two did not. So the conventional was not producing, was not absorbing glyphosate, which makes sense because if it did, it would die. So because these crops are resistant, they're able to soak up the glyphosate and not die, which means that you're getting a much larger residue in the food chain.
Hmm. Now, about these weeds, there's talk that the more you expose, more you apply herbicides, more the weeds develop resistance and become super weeds. Is this a given that it is going to happen?
I mean, they, of course, didn't think so. When they first came out with these crops, they maintained that it was going to cause a reduction in the amount of herbicide that we would need to use. The exact opposite has happened. And you would have thought they could predict that that's what would happen, because this is what always happens in biology. These forms are very capable of evolving to get around the toxins that are exposed to them. So now we have these super weeds coming up in the GMO Roundup-ready crops. And the solution to me is really horrifying. And they've managed to come up now with crops that are also resistant to another herbicide called 2,4-D. 2,4-D is a component of Agent Orange, which was used in the Vietnam War to defoliate areas. It's just a terrible toxic chemical. Now we're going to have, it looks like they're going to approve the combination of both Roundup Ready and 2,4-D Ready in the same crop, which means we'll have both of those toxic chemicals together in our food supply. It's almost always the case that when you put two of these chemicals together that do things in different ways, they are synergistically toxic, which means that they're worse than the combination is worse than the linear sum of the effects of the two. It can be exponential. So we're going to have even worse, I think, disease issues coming down the road once we've got a regular level of 2,4-D in our food supply along on top of the glyphosate.
Mm. So is it fair to say that this method, this very philosophy is going to put us on an unending chemical treadmill?
Absolutely. I mean, we're just headed for disaster. We're just going to, it's like an escalation in a war where we can't possibly win. And what we will finally do is poison all life on Earth. I think that will be the ultimate solution, which will certainly solve the human overpopulation problem.
So, okay. So here is a last few questions. One of them is about this funding by the corporations, by the industry of science, of universities, of research, of journals, of media. Is science losing its independence and objectivity because of this?
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly what I'm seeing. I am really stunned that when you look at the papers on looking at the exposure of mammals to Roundup, and the studies, most of the studies were done by the companies that are producing the product. So it's obviously in their best interest not to show a result. The studies are done on mice for 3 months or on rats. For 3 months. So a 3-month study is short enough so that you don't see the damage. There was a study that was done by Seralini et al. That lasted for the entire lifetime of the rats, and he showed extensive damage. He showed huge mammary tumors in the females. He saw kidney failure, kidney distress, and liver distress in the males. He saw early death, so these animals didn't live as long as their non-GMO. These were rats that were fed GMO Roundup Ready feed. Clear evidence of harm for this paper where he studied the rats over their entire lifetime. The journal managed to get his paper retracted last November on Thanksgiving on improper grounds. It was retracted because of lack of statistical significance. And it turns out that all the papers that were published by the Monsanto, by the industry, which were showing supposedly that glyphosate is harmless to these rats, also had the same small sample size. But they only went for 3 months instead of for the full lifetime. So basically all the studies that have been done on Roundup to see if it's toxic to mammals should be retracted. And this means that we haven't studied this question, which is astonishing to me because Roundup is the most heavily used herbicide on the planet. And how we cannot bother to even see if it's toxic to mammals is beyond my comprehension.
So is Seralini now engaged in another study of more detail, or no, that's no more allowed?
Well, he hasn't yet come up with another study on rats. I mean, he may be working on one. I don't know what he's up to. He certainly is continuing to publish, and he's continuing to find evidence of harm. He's published a number of papers showing that Roundup is extremely toxic at the level, for example, of looking at individual cell types and growing them, exposing them to minute amounts of Roundup and showing harm. It's very clear that it's very toxic to cells.
So here's my one of the last questions, Stephanie. If governments will not fund science, and we know that industry is only tilting the science, is making science biased, so what is the alternative?
I think it has to be a grassroots effort by the consumer. And I encourage everybody I know to eat an exclusive organic diet. This is what my husband and I buy, only organic foods at Whole Foods Market. I just found out today that Walmart is introducing an organic oats that will be at competitive prices. So I'm hoping that more and more stores will find it necessary to increase their availability of organic choices for the consumer, because the consumer will demand it. And the consumer certainly should take this matter into their own hands, because the governments are just in bed with the industry. It's not going to come down from the government. It's going to happen grassroots through consumer demand. And I believe that the farmers, I suspect there are many farmers who would be delighted to not have to use these toxic chemicals on their crops. I'm sure it's causing harm to the farmers to be exposed to these chemicals. So if they can also start switching to organic foods, it can happen. I think it can happen without the help of governments. That's the way it's going to happen, because the governments are too controlled by the industry.
So do you personally feel, Stephanie, that your research might also be jeopardized because of pressure of the kind that Seralini faced?
Absolutely. I mean, they're certainly trying to discredit my work. They're trying to claim that I don't have the credentials to be saying what I'm saying. And, or, you know, they're going to try to do that, of course. So the consumers are going to have to decide who's right. I mean, anyone who's listening to this, you can either believe me or you can believe them. It's your choice.
No, I did not mean that.
It would be a lot better if you switch to an organic diet, and certainly that's what I'm doing.
We buy
organic spices, organic beer. I mean, we are doing everything organic in this household.
I see. No, my question was more specific to funding. I mean, do you think that your work might come to be jeopardized because your funding is being restricted, or there is an effort to take away funding of your work and so on?
My funding, I am extremely pleased. My funding comes from a computer company, and they're funding me to do work in computer science. And they're very interested in the tools that I'm developing, which will allow other people, if I can do this correctly, it will allow other people to use the same methods I'm using. And I think these methods are very powerful. That involves, basically, you can take a pile of papers on a topic, let's say glyphosate, you can throw them into the computer and let the computer number crunch on these papers, and then it can allow you to explore these papers cross-dimensionally, where you can find paragraphs that are on specific topics that the computer has identified are important. And it can tell you links among different, just getting a bunch of words that are linked together gives you huge hints about what's going on in the biology and causes you to refocus your efforts towards directions that will help to explain what you're seeing. So you learn much more from the research literature than has actually been done so far. I feel like it allows you to open doors. The literature has a rich, rich amount of information in it that where the dots have not yet been properly connected. So I think we're going to see more breakthroughs in biology. We actually understand biology very poorly right now, and we need to be able to cut loose into a more open-minded view of what's going on in biology so that we can explain it properly. And this will get to the underlying cause of these important diseases like Alzheimer's and autism, and heart disease too, by the way, that will allow us to then know how we can change our lifestyle to prevent these diseases from happening to ourselves and our loved ones. So I think this is very, very important. The company that is funding me is willing to continue funding me for what I'm doing in allowing biology to be more easily understood and interpreted.
Oh, that's wonderful. That means there is always a competition from unexpected sources. So the computer, your funding source on computer systems is hoping that what you are doing to biology with the use of computer tools can also perhaps be done on similar fields by more and more research scientists.
That's what I'm hoping. We're trying to build tools that will allow. I run these tools myself, but I'm a computer scientist. I know how to do it. But we're hoping to open it up so that even a biologist who doesn't have the computer science skills will be able to use these same tools and take advantage of them in the same way that I'm doing it.
I see. And would you say that to study the harmful effects of glyphosate, for example, one needs to be a biologist or more a biochemist or a chemist?
That's a good question. Yeah, no, you need to know a lot. I have read, I've been ferociously reading the literature in a huge space, you know, to try to understand all the nuances. And physics is definitely a really important part of it and an underappreciated part of biology. So we're looking into biophysics. I'm struggling right now with a team of very bright people. We're trying to figure out the biophysics, and it has to do with electricity in the body and how the blood flows. And these things are really deep and difficult questions that we are trying to understand, because I believe that all modern diseases that are on the rise are a consequence of impairment in the blood flow, and that this is due to a system-wide deficiency in sulfate. And sulfate is a really critical molecule to the body that's difficult to manage, but incredibly important to maintain the blood flow. So that's kind of my core research area right now, and it involves electricity and consideration of things like streaming potential. These are very difficult topics that are actually related to electrical engineering, which I have some background in, so that works out well, because I can kind of combine my knowledge of electrical engineering with my knowledge of biology to try to figure this out. But it's very, very difficult stuff, and we don't have it worked out yet.
I see. But to go back to basic, if sulfate and electricity and biophysics is important, but does it all still lead to how chemicals such as glyphosate is involved in damaging us, whether biophysically or electrically or what have you?
Absolutely, yes. Glyphosate actually totally messes up many parts of the system, especially these ions, because glyphosate cages these ions and prevents them from playing the role they're supposed to play. For example, heme iron is another example. I mentioned cobalamin. Cobalt is hiding inside a cobalamin molecule. Iron typically hides inside a heme molecule that's also produced by the gut bacteria to provide us with heme iron, which is a much healthier form of iron than free iron. Free iron can be toxic. So now we face, in fact, this is related to heart disease, we face both iron deficiency and iron excess today because of the iron being in the wrong place, namely caged inside the glyphosate molecule. That's what I'm thinking, that glyphosate is caging the iron and preventing it from being utilized in the right way in the heme group. And so heme is really important in several different enzymes in the body that are now deficient because of the influence of glyphosate on the iron. And that's just one example. So iron, of course, is also a magnetic, these minerals have, you know, magnetic properties. They can respond to electromagnetic fields. And we do have increasingly people who are very hypersensitive to electromagnetic fields in the environment. And I think that's also due to the disruption of these minerals that can be magnetized. So this is all very fascinating stuff and deep and hard science that is what really excites me. I'm very interested in it, but we haven't figured it all out yet. We're still struggling with it.
Fantastic. That brings us to a close. Really fantastic. As a last advice to the listeners, apart from trying to go organic as if your life depended on it, What else can they do? Can they try growing food, even if it's a little bit of it possible within in their backyard, in their porch, in their wherever?
I think they should. And in fact, I really think it would be great for people to, whoever has a plot of land, to grow food on it, because we could end up with a real crisis once enough people wake up and realize how toxic the food is. You can anticipate that there's going to be a huge demand for organic coming up, way more than the supply can deliver as we transition, as the farmers slowly transition towards an organic model. And the price is going to skyrocket, and people should all think in terms of growing their own organic food, if at all possible, in their own backyard. Absolutely, I think that would be a great thing to do, and possibly even essential at this point.
And that brings us to the end of today's podcast. I shall be happy to hear your views or any requests, any suggestions. You are free to email me at tony.mitra@gmail.com. Meanwhile, have a great weekend and a holiday. Take care. Bye.